Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Well, we had a huge response to last week's episode, my conversation with UFO expert Rob Christofferson. I had asked you to email me and send in what you're thankful for. Well, that didn't happen, but you know what did? A ton of people absolutely obsessed about the part of our conversation where we talked about whether Bigfoot was male or female. I gotta tell you, I was shocked. I had no idea my audience was so knowledgeable about Bigfoot junk. And I'm telling you, I got a lot of information I'm not sure how comfortable I am dealing with. Most of you wanted me to know that there actually are a lot of witness accounts that confirm that the Bigfoot they saw was male. So plenty of people see a Bigfoot that is male. Others see a Bigfoot that they identify as female. I have no idea what the percentages are, but thank you for clearing that up. One email I got from Matthew pointed out, like a lot of you did, the famous story of Albert Ostman, who claimed that he was kidnapped by a Bigfoot and spent 6 days more or less held captive by a family of Bigfoots. It's a strange story. It's definitely an outlier in the kinds of Bigfoot encounters you typically hear about. But he identified the family of Bigfoots as basically a dad and a mom and 2 kids, one boy and one girl. And he had 6 days to check them out and figure out what was going on downstairs. So there's that. But then Matthew in his email goes on to say, and look, fair warning, we're about to get into a lot of penis talk and some gorilla sex talk. So either skip this part or pull over and turn it up. I don't know. Matthew says, it's quite possible that Bigfoot, plural, have teeny tiny willies. Our largest primate, the gorilla, has the smallest penis in relation to its size of any mammal on Earth. On average, less than 1.25 inches. Yes, 1 1/4 inch long. He also has very minuscule testicles. I believe I read once that a full-grown gorilla penis is actually smaller than the average penis of a newborn human. Okay, now Matthew goes on to say, there's evolutionary reasons for this. When you beat the poop out of everyone that wants to play hide the pickle with the girls in your harem, by the way, I'm glad Matthew's keeping it scientific and not talking down to me. He probably figured he had to talk down to me. I don't blame him. It's practically impossible to condescend to me. I mean, I'm just already right down there all the time. Anyway, if you have no competition in terms of mating, he says, there's no reason to have a larger anything. So, and then he says, heck, even gorilla sperm is slow and they have a low sperm count. Okay, so getting a lot of information from Matthew. I have confirmed none of it, so I'm just telling you what Matthew told me. But I guess Matthew was suggesting that maybe Bigfoot and gorillas operate the same way when it comes to mating. But then that gets into the other big debate, which is Bigfoot a flesh and blood, paws and claws animal, or more of an interdimensional UFO space ghost? And the whole thing about whether Bigfoot is murdering our pets, tearing them apart, I can't even get into now because I clearly touched a nerve. So for now, all I'm going to say is this. Based on your response, I am currently lining up a Bigfoot expert to come on the show and we'll get their insights and perspectives and knowledge and opinion on this subject, the whole range of questions about Bigfoot and whether he or she or they are getting enough action. Okay, so that's coming up. And if you have questions for the Bigfoot expert, email those to me. Forget about what you're thankful for. It doesn't matter. I need Bigfoot questions. That's what this season is all about. All right, so send me those and we'll ask our expert once I get that lined up. Okay, that said, today we welcome the awesome, the fascinating Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross. Now, Tom Ross, you may remember, was the young man who was at the center of the RHPB episode, The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. He and his cousin and his aunt and uncle spent 4 terrifying, completely surreal days in a condo in the Mammoth Mountain ski valley, where pretty much from the minute they got there, they were plagued and entertained and frightened by one of the most active poltergeists I've ever heard of. So today on the show, Tom is going to tell you what it was like to be there, what's happened to him since then, and Jenny, his wife, fills in the blanks because she was actually the one who wrote the book based on his firsthand account and also the recollections of his aunt and uncle and cousin who were there. And Jenny is also a paranormal author, both fiction and nonfiction, in her own right. So it's great having them both on the show. Now, here's a quick note. If you're a listener on Patreon, you're going to get a slightly expanded version of this conversation with a few extra stories at the end and an update on what's going on with that condo in Mammoth Mountain now. So if you want a little more of today's interview, go ahead and sign up for Patreon at the Obsessed Fan level, and you'll get the unedited version, okay? So, the first thing I ask Tom and Jenny is how they met and fell in love. That's where we start, okay? And then we will get into all the ghost stuff, all right? So, here we go. In the order of the book, the first thing I want to know, which I am fascinated by, I want to hear the love story, and I want to hear about how you guys met, because that to me, I love that. Can you tell us about that night? What happened? Because I love when people come together spooky, you know?
Yeah, I guess. Well, I had been going to, there was a bar in downtown Orlando. It's still around, but it's not at that location anymore, and we still go there like every Saturday night pretty much. It used to be right downtown, and we used to go there with my now ex-husband. We've been going there for several years. Tom had been going there for a few years. Although you moved here.
Yeah, I wasn't going there for years. There for maybe about a year.
Yeah, I'm a Florida native, so I've been around like my whole life. But but he had just moved here like a year or two before.
Yeah, Jen was married when I first met her.
Yes.
And we were friends for a while before we were a thing. We were actually business partners before we started going out with each other.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a like fucking love at first sight thing. We were friends. I immediately liked her.
Yeah.
We immediately liked each other, but she was married.
Yeah.
And no, I didn't break the marriage up.
No.
Hey, I didn't say anything.
I thought that he did.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't quite work out.
But Tom, were you married or were you with someone at that time?
I had been divorced for years. No children. Okay. Just I'm single.
Yeah, I was
single and playing a field.
Yeah. So he kind of, and you know, so.
So I have listeners in Orlando. What bar is it?
High Bar.
Independent bar. Which used to be called Barbarella. And now it's called Barbarella again, but they do it one night a week, actually 2 nights a week, I think.
Yeah.
One night a week at a place called The Trap.
Yeah, it used to be downtown at Orange Ave and
Washington,
which that was downtown.
It had been there for like 30-something years.
And before that, it was the old goth club. It used to be called Visage.
Oh, my God.
Around.
Now, okay, just so I've got the timing right. When you guys met, it was the year of our Lord 19...
No, it was 2010?
Yeah, about 2010.
I think we met in 2010.
Yeah. 15 years ago. Okay, got it.
Yeah. I think it was around then. It might have been 2009, but it was right around that.
Because we knew of each other a couple years before.
Because I kept seeing him around. I mean, he was he'd only been in the scene at that club for probably like a year or two. Because like I said, he had just moved to Florida.
Yeah.
But, you know, he stood out because, you know, he was a real snappy dresser. He was a good dancer. He was very outgoing. So a lot of people knew him. And I just kept seeing him. Like I said, I was married at the time, but me and the husband were kind of, you know what I mean? My first marriage was 14 years. Like, you know, so we were kind of a little bit, I don't know, on the outs a little bit. And I just kept seeing him and I was like, who is that guy? Like, he's just like really interesting. And then I think that I seem to remember. And when I was rereading the book today, I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I kept seeing you around, but I'm really shy. So I'm not going to like go up and say anything to anybody. Right. And so I think I passed you, like I was going out to the front bar and you were coming in from the front bar. Mm-hmm. And you said something about, you like my necklace or something. I don't even remember what necklace it was. Yeah. But you said something about that. And then we just talked for a couple minutes. And then like after that, we just kept talking to each other like every, because we would come out every week.
Yeah.
Actually, for a while, we were going out several nights a week.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Well, by that time, you were already separated.
Yeah. And like I said, over the course of that time, like me and my husband kind of separated. Yeah. We were living in the same house for a while just because I was looking for a job in Orlando because we lived in Daytona. And
okay. Well, so, what I find fascinating is that if I understand the chronology correctly, there were a number of things as you guys got to know each other. There were, you know, like people do when they're dating, you know, you kind of tell stories and you kind of reveal bits and pieces and a little bit more. And Tom shared a whole lot with you before he said, okay, there's this story about what happened when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I'm just curious about that, Tom. I mean, that one was one that you kind of held back a little bit. What was the feeling there?
Well, you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, we were just talking. She was talking. She was writing horror. And I appreciate horror and horror movies, but they don't really scare me. And she's like, why don't they scare you? And it says, because I had something that was really scary happen to me. It was for real, you know? And she's like, what? And it says, I saw a poltergeist. And she didn't believe me.
I think, so, yeah, I think he thought I knew that, because I'm a very skeptical, still am, actually.
So, Tom, you were a little bit like, if I say this, that this actually happened to me, she's not going to just fall right into it. And this might end up being a little bit of a bump or something, kind of a.
I didn't really care.
He did again.
I didn't really care.
I think he knew me enough by that point that, because like I said, he told me like worse shit than that.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like, okay. Oh, and I was all right with it. Yeah. So it took him a while before he got to that point. And I was just kind of like, at that point, I was like, not real sure. I believe it. But I was like, but on the other hand, why would he make up something?
Right.
Like
so
that?
I told her from the very beginning what I could remember of happened at that time. And then, she's like, huh? And I says, that's what you need to write a book about.
Oh.
And I said, I'll let you talk to my aunt and uncle. And unprompted, she knew she was, I think you were living with me at that time. You were living with me by that time.
Because we hung out for like maybe a year and a half or something like that. And then we started dating. And then like probably about 8 months after that, we moved in together, I think.
So I got on the phone and called my aunt and uncle out in California. My uncle was still alive at that time. Uncle Red's passed since then. And without any prompt, she could hear us talking. We were like on speakerphone and they were remembering more about it than I was. And I was going, yeah, that's right. And remember when this happened? And then she was like, damn, that happened. And I said, yeah, we all saw it.
Yeah. I think that was when that was really solidified for me. It's like when they, because he didn't say, hey, tell her this or anything like that. He hadn't talked to them in a long time.
I hadn't talked to them years.
And just the fact that we were all there on the speakerphone with them and they were coming up with, they were like, oh yeah, remember that? And like, it was almost exactly like what Tom had told me.
Yeah, they remember, my Aunt Lois remembered things slightly differently, certain events that had happened. And I was like, no, that's not how that happened. I remember how it happened. It didn't happen that way. Which that's a long story, but I put any differences in the story. We put those in the book.
And it was pretty close.
Yeah.
But I do remember that there were certain points in the book where, Jenny, you made as the author, you would say, now at this point, this person remembers it slightly differently. And here's the way they remember it now. But coming from this other person, it's a little bit, but it was never diametrically opposed. It was always just a little like, okay, here's my version of it.
Yeah, like just slightly different details. Like I said, it was minor shit, like you remembering the lamp looking differently than she remembered it, or the thing
when
about
she
the,
reminded me of how the lamp really looked to it. Okay, she had a picture of it, didn't she?
I don't think there was a picture. I put the pictures that she sent me in the book.
Because she says another thing is that of the lamp is that I couldn't plan this shit out. And then have pictures back from the early 80s, Polaroid pictures of objects just sitting in places. Like, why the hell would you just take a picture of this object just sitting in place? It's because we were taking pictures of things after it had happened. And we were trying to figure out what the rules were. How does this thing work? What is
it? Right. Because the stuff you talk about is classic poltergeist stuff. Oh, I'm sorry. And I just want to tell you really quick. I'll sort of jump in here. And I don't know if you guys have listened, but I recorded an episode of my podcast that discusses your book.
Oh, I'd like to hear it. Yeah.
And it was my very first live show. So it was done in Los Angeles in front of an audience of maybe 75 people.
Oh, cool. Oh,
cool.
So here's a story I want to tell you, because at that location, it's this place called the Earl Gallery in Koreatown, a very old building that used to be a speakeasy. I mean, this place goes back over 100 years. And the guy who administers it had told me, well, it's a creepy old place, but I've never really experienced anything supernatural. Well, the week of the show, I come in the day that we're going to record the show, and he's like, oh, I've got to tell you, I had a ghost experience right here. And I'm like, really, what is it? He's like, okay, the stage you're standing on, you see that door right behind you? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, that's a storeroom, and there's a bunch of stuff in there, but it's accessible. Except when I tried to get in there yesterday, I put the key in and I pushed the door, and the door slammed up against something and it wouldn't open. Mm. And somehow the stuff inside that room had all moved forward and blocked the door.
Yeah, that's poltergeist.
And I'm like, wait a second. That's the exact same thing that happens in the book that I'm going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, the bunk bed moved against them.
Yeah.
It was the bunk bed. Yeah. And he's like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah, that exact same thing, that thing of furniture moving against a door in such a way that no physical human being could have done it, because you would have had to be in the room, but then how do you get out of the room? Like, none of it makes any sense. He's like, that is so creepy, because nothing's ever happened before, but this week that happened.
Yeah.
Oh, you did it from afar, Tom.
No.
I'm not accusing anyone, Tom, but I'm just saying.
There's what is commonly called poltergeist phenomenon is usually associated with a person, usually a young person. It's not usually location-based, but location can influence the phenomenon sometimes in different ways. Now, my friend Steve Mara, who's a parapsychologist from England,
oh, what's his name?
Steve Mara.
Jen's written a few of his books.
I wrote some books with him, I wrote one about the Rochdale poltergeist, and I wrote one about the Keith Linder case in Seattle or wherever that was.
Now, he's open-minded on a bunch of different things. He doesn't really shut down. He'll consider any theory. And he says there are some hauntings that seem to have poltergeist-like phenomenon in them. In other words, moving objects. But it's not centered around a person. It's centered around a location. But I have never seen anything like that. Okay. Anytime poltergeist, from my point of view, is always centered around me. It's wherever I am.
Yeah, pretty much everything that, and more things happen. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Because I know we added some stuff to the book later, like in the second edition.
It
because stuff had started happening at our old house in Sanford, like after we started working on the book. And because we were talking about the book all the time, and we were talking to Lois and Red, and I was interviewing them. And so, you know, we were kind of, it was kind of poltergeist focused at the time, and stuff started happening in our house.
Let's talk about it.
So I actually got to see it firsthand, which was actually really cool.
Okay. So in the book in the version that I read, which is this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. In the story that Tom is telling about when he was 13 and it was the Christmas trip.
Yeah.
What's fascinating, and what I think is important to note, is exactly what Tom was saying. The haunting, as it were, began in the condo in Mammoth Mountain. Mm-hmm. And then there was such a feeling of relief when you guys left. It's like, okay, we're leaving, and the stress and the tension and the weirdness of all that, we're leaving it behind. And you go to your aunt and uncle's house. And it starts up again.
Yeah.
Which is so scary, and I think so devastating and demoralizing, the feeling that, oh, is this never going to end? And the part that really, Tom, I want to get your sort of reaction and feelings on this. the notion that you had when you were a kid, when you began to realize or think, what if this is my fault?
Yeah.
That really touched me because you know, your parents had broken up, your dad had moved out, your mom was dating, you know, Ray, and and you were not a happy kid. And often when a kid is in a situation like that, they feel like everything is my fault. And now suddenly there's a haunting. What were those feelings like? That must have been hard.
Well, at the time, you know, you're 13, you're only experiencing what's happening. You're not really looking at any deeper meaning behind it. I just thought it was a ghost. But during the phenomenon, I realized that I suspected that it could read my mind because it would move things I was thinking about. If I looked at something too long, it might move it later if I worried about it. I told Red, I said, I think this thing's reading my mind. And he's like, why you think that? Because I had a feeling that object was going to move, you know, it could have been any old object. He says, it can read my thoughts. And he's like, oh, don't say that. It was stuff like that. But then after several days of it, I thought to myself, what if some way I can make it move an object? Maybe it's me and I can make it moved the object I want to do. And I tried to move it. I said, I want that object to move over there. And that ended the entire thing. Having a conscious awareness of it or an acceptance of it somehow foils it. And when it does happen, because it still happens every now and then, but it's nothing like it was. It's always when I'm either extremely frustrated or extremely absent-minded. Like have you ever driven home from work? You don't really remember the drive. If you're in that state of mind.
Yeah. If you're just like spaced out.
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me is the theory that you came up with, which I think at least metaphorically makes a lot of sense, that we all know we have a right brain and a left brain.
Yeah.
And the left brain is the one that keeps track of things. And the right brain is the one that comes up with ideas when you're taking a shower and suddenly you think of something. And this idea that it's the right side of the brain, and tell me if I have your theory correct, that sometimes under some, you know, emotional or mental condition exteriorizes itself and is quote unquote doing, you know, becoming the ghost, moving the things around.
Yeah.
The left brain isn't aware of that and is witnessing it and going, what's happening? And what's fascinating is that as soon as it's like the two sides look at each other or become aware of each other and the left brain goes, right brain, are you doing this? It shuts down. It's like, gone. I'm out.
Yeah. I cannot do it by conscious will. It's only unconscious desire. And it seems to happen in times where I'm frustrated and I can't physically take action. All right. That's one thing. Or if I'm extremely relaxed and like in a almost kind of like in a transcendental meditational type phase, then there can be some what's called recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. Usually something in the room might shake like that. But then as soon as you become aware of it, it settles down and stops.
Jenny, have you seen this?
I have seen it. Yeah. But like I said, when we wrote the book, he had just told me about it and I hadn't seen anything. And I used to tell him, it's like, man, it'd be so cool. You know what I mean? Like because I'd never seen anything paranormal and stuff. And it's funny because when the first time that it happened after this, like when we were living together, we'd been together quite a long time at that point. And it was like maybe a year or two after the book had come out and we were at home and our friends were over. A couple that we've known for a long time, and they were over. I think your mom was there.
Yeah.
And we were trying to watch a movie. I think we were trying to watch Mad Max Fury Road.
Fury Road.
Actually, we were trying to rent it.
Yeah.
And because they hadn't seen it yet, we'd seen it six times, but you know, we wanted them to see it. I love that movie. But yeah. So it wasn't working. Like we couldn't get it to work, and I was just like, what the hell? Like this isn't working. And we're trying to like call the cable company or whatever the hell. And trying to like figure everything out. So everyone was just getting kind of annoyed because we wanted to watch this movie and it wasn't working out. And then all of a sudden we're just all sitting around there on the couch getting kind of pissed off. And the remote control went just picked up off the table and went, and then it fell on the floor. And when it hit the floor, it went bam, like it was a brick, like it was heavy. And it's just plastic, you know what I mean? It's just like a little plastic.
Yeah, it didn't bounce. It went boom.
It didn't bounce. It just went boom.
Like whatever had it still like holding loud. Onto it. Bow.
And like for a second, yeah. I thought, did I just kick the table? Like the coffee table? And then our friends, Dimitri and Jen, they looked at me. That like we all looked at each other and they're like, did you just fucking see that? They're like, that just fucking moved.
And I was zoned out. I saw it happen out of the corner of my eye, but I didn't really care. And my mother said that just flew off the table.
Yeah.
And they started to get excited about it. And I kind of snapped out of it and I went, yeah, okay. they said, Tom, did you do that? And I went, yeah. And I felt all the hair stand up on the back of my neck like that. And I had this wave of fear, like it was coming for me, like it was coming back. And I looked down at my feet and there was a stack of coins in front of my feet. A little stack of coins, and I stepped back like that. And I said, it brought me the money, which goes back to a few days before when me and Jen were talking about it. I says, yeah, I wish it would do something useful, like bring me a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And it did. It brought me money, but it brought me money from the side of my nightstand. Take a
little stack of coins.
I was thinking a pile of cash from the bank.
That's kind of what we were thinking.
But it only had the ability to brought me. And I said, it brought me the money.
Yeah.
And I was started laughing. I go, okay, I got it. And Dimitri goes, do it again.
He's like, do it again, Tom.
And I had to kind of like fight it back, because once the ball gets rolling, it could get dangerous. So, and I don't like it. Because imagine, have you ever had a nightmare?
Yeah.
And in your nightmare, there's characters and people in there you don't like, or maybe they hate you, or maybe they're trying to kill you. Well, that's what's doing it. It's that part of your brain. So you're trusting it with a lot of power. It might kill me. I don't know. I have a fear that it will kill me because I feel that it hates me sometimes. But then sometimes it's chilled out. It's emotionally erratic.
Just weird shit.
And it can move an object. It can teleport objects, evidently, because they appear from nowhere. It has, I guess, unlimited strength. It can move things more than I can. I can bench press 320 pounds, and this thing is stronger than that. And it could probably make something appear out of midair and hit you on the head with it and kill you. And I'm just afraid.
Kind of what I was always worried.
Yeah, it's never really touched me. All right, but I'm and I actually don't want to see what it looks like, because I've always kind of afraid that I'd see it. But I never really did.
Yeah, you remember you said that too. And you,
like a haze.
When you were a kid, you were just, you saw the haze thing like that. But
yeah, I was afraid I was going to see it. It was going to look like a corpse.
Yeah.
So this is interesting.
Like a corpse or a skeleton or something.
So Tom, you've in a way given it, I don't know if you've given it this power or it's demonstrated power and you've deduced from that what its power is. But I'm wondering if you've ever thought, maybe I should make an effort to think of it and characterize it differently to myself, and then it will behave differently, and then I won't have to worry about it.
One of the things that it did was when I get really scared, it would do something that was humorous to try to lighten the mood, and then it would start to act humorous. So it was whatever, it was mirroring whatever your emotional was, and it didn't seem to want you to go over the edge, because it wanted to continue demonstrating. It didn't want you to stop.
Well, that really sounds like the part of the book where you and your uncle were sort of engaged with it, asking it to do something, closing the door, opening the door. Did it do it? Which is such a perfect sort of childlike play. That really is one of the most fascinating things I've ever read in any book about poltergeists or hauntings.
Yeah, it was interactive and in live time. And you felt like you were being watched at certain times, sometimes more than others. I heard it speak once, or try to speak. That was fucking bizarre.
Tell us about that. It was in the book, but it's so fascinating and scary. What is it?
I was laying in bed and I thought a bubble in a pipe went broom. And I was looking over in that direction in the room, and there was nothing there. And it went, like that. And I just got up and bolted out of
out of the room. I don't blame you.
Yeah. That is terrifying.
I know. Yeah, I got creeped out the first time you told me that. I was sounded
like it was somebody underneath the water trying to speak, and it was kind of backwards sounding. It was trying to, but it was getting clearer. I didn't want to hear what it was trying to say, but it can move objects, so it can move the air. And, you know, sound is just moving air. It was trying to mix a voice, but I didn't want to hear it. And never tried it again.
Just to be 100% clear, your feeling is that whatever this is, it is coming 100% from your physical being, or do you feel there is also a completely exterior element?
During a time when most of this was going on and it was really strong, I thought it was totally an outside force. As soon as I suspected I had something to do with it, it fell apart. It stopped doing it. Now, when I got older, in moments of weakness, it would come back. But it didn't impress me as much as it did before. I wasn't as afraid of it. So it never would really spool up, you know, into more. It would usually fizzle out. It is like, you know, a couple months ago, I looked at the TV and a ball of socks fell in front of me from out of nowhere. And that's when I rolled up a pair of socks.
There it goes again.
It was from the, you know, nah, you know. Or I was looking across the top of a shelf and my eyes hit a ring, a stainless steel ring. It was just some biker chick gave it to me. It was a skull. And I looked at it just for a second. When I looked away, I saw it in the corner of my eyes jump off the counter and fluttered down side to side like this, like it was a leaf, but it went fast. And I saw it do that, and it didn't even faze me. And I went, wait a minute, hold on. And I looked at it, was sitting there on the ground. That was, I saw that. Now Jen has seen some stuff too. It ringing the doorbell in the middle of the night, opening the garage door.
It opened our
turned the TV on.
It opened our back patio doors, and the deadbolt was still engaged.
The deadbolt was still engaged. The back
and it was just wide open. Like I got up for work in the morning, and it was just wide open.
It's in the morning, yeah.
Wide open with the deadbolt sticking out.
With the deadbolt sticking out.
It was a double door.
Yeah.
Deadbolt was engaged, and we never opened that door.
We never opened that door ever.
And the cat was sitting there looking at it.
Like, what?
Here's what's really interesting, and this freaks me out. Do you guys know? That is that motion you described, the falling leaf,
like a
that
falling
is
leaf.
A very, very common aspect of UFO sightings.
Really?
Okay. Did you know this?
No, I didn't know that.
The people looking in the sky at night and seeing a light and seeing it move and then seeing it descend in
like
this, they call it a falling leaf motion.
Yeah. Interesting.
Now, it leads me to a question. We've been talking about poltergeists, but there's many other paranormal things in the world. Have you ever, have you seen UFOs?
No. I'd like to see one.
He always makes jokes about, he opens the blinds at night and he's just like, I'm going to leave it open in case the UFO goes by.
I've seen other forms of this phenomenon though. Eventually what ends up happening is when you get older, it can, with me, it got into sometimes, one in particular was a spontaneous out-of-body experience. And I did that when I was in the Army, and I was in a barracks with my roommate, and he saw it happen. And there was some RSPK, the microwave shaking and popping, and the little mini fridge shaking. And then I was seeing everything from above. A 360-degree field, I felt like I was a ping-pong ball. I could see in every direction at once. But I wasn't seeing light, though. It was just actually seeing matter itself. It looked like cigarette smoke, glowing cigarette smoke. You could see, I looked at it more closely, and I could see atoms fucking just jumping around and pop, pop, popping around. I could see molecules. And I was only out for a few seconds, and then he shook me out of it and because things were shaking. In the room, he shook me out of it. He said that I would look like I was comatose, so he thought I was dead. And when I was out, time was different, it was moving more slowly. So the time space is different when you're
you might have gone interdimensional, perhaps.
I was kind of aware of different levels and of fucking like frequencies to reality, like a almost like radio frequencies, almost you can go higher or lower in energy.
So for you, it felt like it was a longer amount of time. And then when you came out of it, your buddy in the barracks said it was just a few seconds.
Yeah, yeah. It was like about 6-7 seconds. But to me, it felt like it was about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because the 360-degree vision is something that gets described in near-death experiences all the time.
Yeah, he's had
and yet you weren't, it wasn't that thing that other people have described where it's like, I'm in the corner of the room and I could see all of you and all of it looked very realistic. You almost had like a heat vision.
Yeah. Well, okay, if you ever rub your eyes and you see a bunch of glowing lights when you're rubbing your eyes are closed. It's imagine that, but geometric shapes of the things that are in a room. The colors don't make any sense. It's bright red or bright blue or yellow or, you know. And as you look at things, you kind of zoom in on them. If you might be able to see something for a second from two opposing points of view, like you can see one side of the object from one point of view and the other side of the object at the same time, like you're bilocating. I saw it did that for a second, but it confused me, so it went away. If you want to see an object on the other side of the room, you just teleport over there, boom, and then you're right on it. Time is very slowed down. You have plenty of time. It's kind of like time isn't quite as real.
How did it feel? Were you scared or were you at peace?
At peace. I would say at peace. Yeah. And I was kind of amazed. I was elated, you know, I was like, wow, this is amazing. It's real. Cause I'd heard about it.
Now, this happened after your motorcycle accident. Is that correct?
No, before.
Before. I think this it was a couple weeks before.
And then I had the motorcycle wreck.
Yeah.
And in the motorcycle accident, you had what you describe as sort of a classic near-death experience?
Yeah. A light came down and got me and went up into a tunnel and everybody I knew was there and they're going through a life review and your manager's there. I call it a manager. You know, it's a bigger one.
He's sitting there. To your manager.
Yeah, he's like your case manager.
He's right.
Like in Beetlejuice.
You got to go back. Says you got to go back. No, I don't want to go back, man. I'm home. He says, no. You got to go back because remember you have to do this and this and that. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, and it's just, yeah, but you won't remember any of this later, okay?
Oh, I hate that.
You'll remember any of this later. And then somebody says, make sure to tell everybody this and that. And I don't remember what I was supposed to tell. But I remembered some of the people that were there. I knew them, but I couldn't tell you who they were. They were like from other lives or something. One of them I remember was a girl, but I don't even think she was human. I think she was what I would know now, what I would call now, maybe like maybe Homo erectus, or maybe I wouldn't say she wasn't as primitive as an australopithecine or anything, but she was small.
Hold on. I just want to, because this is really crazy that you're bringing this up right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm just literally reading. I read in a book yesterday about a person who had an experience where they, it was not a near-death experience, but they had begun to sense that their spirit guides were around. And one of them appeared to be early man, like Homo erectus. And you're saying that someone you saw appeared to be an earlier strain of humanity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was female. Kind of reminded me of, she had what you would call scientifically facial prognathism, you know, where a muzzle.
Right.
She had a slight muzzle. She had slight fangs and kind of a very short nose. I wouldn't say it was as short as a chimp's nose, but she was pretty.
Who do you think they were in relationship to you?
I don't know. They might have been other incarnations of me for all I know. I don't know. But she had a woven cloak on and there were symbols and stuff in it and her hair was braided. And I think she might have had like sideburns that were braided, but they wasn't like man's hair. It was like a woman's hair. But I remember it was kind of like coming out of her face the way some monkeys would have it. You know, it was braided.
Wow.
And yeah, she had little earrings and bones and stuff. But the thing is that she wasn't in color. She was kind of like a 3D representation made out of welding arc. It's the only way I can describe it. Brilliant white prismatic, but so was everything else. So it was difficult to, there wasn't very little distinction of everything. And when a person would talk to you, it was mental images, like telepathy. And as you turned towards them, their faces would kind of materialize out of this white prismatic energy that everything was made of. And you could see them, but they didn't really move that much. It was kind of almost like a like an avatar of them.
Since this near-death experience, people often say that they, you know, that their life changes. They no longer fear death. They see things differently. They approach life differently. Yeah. What has been the after effect for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was kind of fearless anyway. You know, true. I was in an airborne unit. I joined the Gulf War.
Really, you know,
I was already, you know, I ride motorcycles and fucking, you know,
he still does.
And shit, you know what I mean? But I really kind of was, when I joined up to the U.S. Army Airborne Infantry for the first Gulf War, I basically made the decision to live by the sword. And to do that, you agreed to die by the sword. You can't take human life without giving yours up if you have to. And you can't be a bitch about that. You know, I mean, you're killing other people. When your time comes, you have to fucking just take it without complaint, you know, because you can do everything correctly and they can still lob a bomb on top of you or hit you with artillery rounds, or you can't be perfect. So that's just the game you agree to play when you get into that. But having the motorcycle wreck, I was just like, oh, okay, that's all it is. This is kind of just a temporary representation of who we are. It's actually, time and space aren't that real. See, that was the thing. The reason why I believe that I had the spontaneous out-of-body experience a couple weeks before the motorcycle accident is because I think it may have been the same experience, basically, because I think there must be some of us that is outside of space-time. So a part of my subconscious knew that my time may have been very near, that I might be dying soon.
It was like a rehearsal almost.
Kind of like a rehearsal of it.
So
I survived it. They sent me to Walter Reed Army Hospital. I was in a coma, you know, and they brought me back, basically. I probably wasn't going to live. And they thought I would never really walk again. I was paralyzed on the right side, but I snapped back pretty quick.
And I don't remember if we said this in the book, but your mother told me
that she saw me,
that when you were in the wreck,
yeah,
she saw him appear in the kitchen in Brazil.
Oh, that was not in the book.
And I couldn't remember if I put it in there or not. And
she said, you get back in your body.
She said, you get back in your body.
Yeah. And then she,
cause she knew, I mean, she freaked out.
That sounds just like her.
Yeah. Cause you get back in your body. And, she knew something was wrong, that something was happening to me. And just a few hours later, the Army called her. She was in Brazil.
Oh, he said, yeah, you just showed up in the kitchen and said, like, hi, mom, or something
hey, mom.
Like that.
Yeah, it was all happy. Hey, mom.
You don't remember doing that.
No.
What are you doing here?
Okay.
She knew you weren't real.
Okay. Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you're hearing all this. You've heard all this. You understand this. This is Tom. This is the person you're with. You write fiction, but you also describe yourself as a skeptic. Where does this put you?
It's kind of in a weird place, actually, because I'm skeptical of a lot of supernatural kind of stuff, but the stuff that he's told me and the stuff that I've seen, I'm kind of more thinking along the lines of, this is something that is natural. It's just something that we don't understand, and maybe we will understand it at some point in the future.
Electricity used to be paranormal at one time.
Yeah, I kind of think it's something along those lines, because when you said, because I still don't believe that a personality can survive after death. I could be wrong about that.
I mean,
obviously. And I know you do. But I think that all the stuff that I've seen, all the poltergeist activity that I've seen, leads me to believe that it's you doing it. Yeah. I mean, because, like, for example, and this is fairly recent, this was just happened like probably less than a year ago, his dad
I forgot about that.
My dad was dying.
I didn't know he was dying.
He didn't know, but our smoke alarm, and it went off, but not like oh, there's a fire or somebody's burning something, cooking.
It went chirp.
And then the one in the hall did that. And then the one down the hall did that. And I was like, and Tom sat up like that. And he's like, my dad's dying. Yeah. And he called.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we just took him to the hospital.
Yeah, he just went to the hospital. He's dying. Yeah. So I said, I'll be down there.
Because every time something weird happens with that smoke alarm.
The smoke alarm tells me.
It's something to do with his dad.
See, when it happens, you can't control it. You can't make it do things. It's always an outside force telling me something. And then it gives me the message. In the book, The Shining, Stephen King got it right when he told the book. It was Tony that was telling him these things. It wasn't himself. It was Tony. So that's the best way for it to happen is if you believe it's an outside force that's doing it. A ghost, a god, a demon, a person, a supernatural something. But if you're looking at it from the point of view, it's like, I'm going to do this. It will fall apart.
I think there's probably some kind of fail safe.
Yeah.
Because it's like, otherwise people would be doing wizard shit.
Believe me, I've tried to get dice to fall the way I want them to fall. Sure. I'll make some money. It won't happen.
Join the club.
It is not under the control of the conscious mind. It's the unconscious.
Well, okay. So now, Jenny,
the mechanism that does it is quantum. I think it's
the quantum soul theory
from Stuart Hameroff. He was a doctor who was messing with anesthesia, and he says that a lot of the mind is not a binary computer, and there's a bunch of super small quantum particles that are in super entangled around your brain and your neurons that some people might call it a soul. But that stuff is what is making you feel like you're here. If you were to fucking get rid of that cloud of super quantum particles, you'd just be like a computer, a robot. And he knows this because you can give somebody anesthesia and they're no longer conscious of anything that they're doing. They don't have the feeling of being there. Like, I talked to Jen when she came out of surgery for a half hour. She didn't remember any of it. She wasn't there.
Nope. I don't remember a damn thing.
So when you die, I think all those particles are all entangled with one another on a quantum level. And the brain can be gone, but that cloud can still be there. And I think at that point, you probably don't have much memory left. I think that was in the brain. But I think you just have a point of view. You're now just a point of view.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're outside space-time.
All right. Now, we've talked a little bit about sort of the notion of, am I controlling it? Or if I think that something else is doing it, that facilitates it. And Jenny, I want to go back to you because you're a writer, a novelist, and you're engaging in a creative act every day or however often you write. And I'm curious as to how that plays out in your life and in your creativity when your writing is, do you feel it's coming from you? Do you feel it's coming through you? How do you experience your creativity?
You know, what's really interesting about that is that for a long time, I've been wanting to be a writer for as long as I can remember. Like, as soon as I learned to read when I was like 2 or 3 years old, that was all I ever wanted to do. And for a long time, I had a hard time with it. I could think of an idea and stuff, and then I would write it and I'd be like, oh, it sucks. And I just felt like I couldn't get it going. And then interestingly enough, since we already mentioned Stephen King, he wrote a book called On Writing. And that was kind of partially autobiographical, but it was also like kind of writing advice too. And one of the things he said was that I don't do outlines or any shit like that. He's like, I just come up with an idea, like a character I'm putting in this situation, and I just let it go. He's like, and don't worry about it. Just write it. And when I started doing that, I got a lot better at it. And I got a lot more done because I was feeling like I would almost sometimes, because I generally used to like to write by hand, but I kind of got to a point where I could type doing the same thing. But I would write by hand in notebooks because then I felt like I'm not looking at the page. So it's almost like you feel like you're channeling something else. And then you're not worrying about it. You're not worried about, I fucked that up or I used the wrong word or whatever. You just let it out because you can always fix it later. So it kind of is helpful to approach it from that standpoint where you think that it's coming from someplace else, because then you're not getting in your own way. You know, you're not stepping on your own dick.
Well,
right? Which
and,
I...
And-
really used to do.
No, I absolutely know that feeling. And it goes back to what Tom was talking about, that sort of left brain, right brain, where the in a creative act, the editor is always jumping in front going, no, don't do that. No, that's no good. And you want that part to relax.
Yeah.
You want the other part to have free rein to do its thing. Editor can come in later, but you, it is that sort of, oh, I don't have to approach this in a very, like, you know, structured way. I can just sort of relax, start writing, not know where I'm going. It's okay. I'm allowed. And when you do that, you actually, like you said, you achieve much more. And like you said, you can always go back and change it if you need to.
Yeah. It's like, I'm just making it up. It's not like I have to get it right or anything like that. Like the first time, it took me an embarrassingly long time to get to that point. And I think I had kind of started to come to that realization from the Stephen King book, but I think having the discussions that we had about kind of allowing something to happen versus making it happen.
Yeah, very different.
I think that kind of like informed it a lot as well.
It's the same. Okay. What you guys were talking about, you're talking about the creative process by freeing up the mind and allowing the mind to create things. That's a very, that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just that I'm talking about more of physical aspect of that. There's a physical element to that too. Okay. And people have known about it for a long time. This goes back into like Eastern philosophies and martial arts. Have you ever like tried to put a glass down on a table and you fumble it and it falls, but you catch it before it hits the ground, before it hits the ground? Did you ever, you said yes. Did you ever actually decide to catch that or did it just happen?
Yeah, no, it's very unconscious. You're just like,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, boom. Boom. Exactly. That's the same thing Obi-Wan Kenobi was trying to tell Luke Skywalker about when he was in the Millennium Falcon. He says, does the force control you? And he goes, yes, partially it controls you, but it also obeys your feelings. And he goes, just reach out with your feelings. Don't think about it. That's what a lot of martial arts is trying to do. When those dudes are in MMA or any kind of pro fighting and they're in there just beating each other to death, basically, they're not thinking about that. Their brains are almost totally empty. There's no time to think, I'm going to punch, I'm going to do this. Their bodies are moving faster than the mind can actually compute. It's the unconscious animal part of you doing it.
I love that you bring that up. There's no one less sportsmanlike than myself, but I can absolutely understand when I'm watching a basketball game, I don't even know what's happening. These people are just tossing the ball behind their back. They're not looking and someone else catches it and does another thing. And it's almost like they're working as one organism.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, they've been through the moves and it's gotten to the point where it doesn't have to be conscious. It's unconscious.
In Star Wars terminology, they would say they're allowing the force to flow through you.
Right.
Yeah. It's not yours.
It's everywhere.
It's something you're channeling through you. It's everywhere. And life is creating it. And that's exactly what they're talking about. You see, that's not based in something George Lucas came up with. He got all that. He got all that from who's the dude that wrote that book, God of a Thousand Faces?
Joseph
Campbell, yeah.
And Joseph Campbell got all this through a bunch of Eastern philosophies and stuff. They've known about paranormal stuff. They just didn't, they're looking at it through their own cultural lenses.
Now, Tom, you're at this point in your life. I don't know what you're in your 40s now.
I'm almost 60.
He's okay. 50. Oh, hey, you're my age. All right, cool. What consumes you now? What are your goals? What are your questions? What is out there in the future for you, do you think?
Oh, well, I like to build motorcycles and sell them or ride motorcycles. Me and Jenny do the show. I help Jen come up with ideas sometimes for new books. We go to the club, sponsor new clubs, promotes.
When
I met her, I also met my friend Dimitri and his wife, who they were DJs, and we brainstormed the club that we have now. And it's been the longest running club. They've been 15 years, they've been rubbing.
Still going.
We've been doing it here in the Orlando area. We've moved it from venue to venue. But we're
so you guys own a club in Orlando?
No.
We just kind of sponsor the nights.
Sponsor the nights. Got it.
We're club promoters. Yeah. She does all the club flyers, not only for that night, but a lot of the other nights for Tampa, you know, the castle.
Because I'm a graphic designer. That's like my main.
She's made black metal album covers and stuff from some of the local album labels. And she's done album covers to bands she's never even heard of.
Yeah. I love this. It's sort of a creative expression, and it's also live gatherings where people are experiencing music all at the same time.
Right. So I'm medically retired because of that motorcycle accident. So I get 90% of my pay. I was retired with damn near full pay and full medical.
Yeah, because it happened on military.
So I'm retired. I'm medically retired.
They gave him, Tom. Really smart. He had
wanted to reenlist and he couldn't after that because he was too busy.
And I can still work as a federal defense contractor, which I've done that off and on. So yeah, I can go back to work too. Because a lot of the guys that are contractors are VA guys.
Are you actively continuing to research the paranormal?
No, I just see it every now and then. Here's the thing. I've tried to get down to the bottom of it, like a lot of other people that are curious about it. Most of it I found is bullshit. Most of the cases that I read don't check out with me. I'm like, nah, that didn't happen. You know, some of the poltergeist stuff that I've heard says, no, that didn't happen either.
It's like, yeah, that doesn't sound
right. That's bullshit. But then some of them really stand out. It's like, yeah, that happened. And it's really only three of them that I can really come to mind that I say that one of them was Rain Man. What's his name?
Don Decker.
Yeah, Donnie Decker. Donnie Decker, the Rain Man. And he could make it rain in his prison cell. The guards had come see him. They were scared of him. He made it rain inside of houses. He was just a very depressed guy who'd been molested by his grandfather, and then he went to jail, and he was very torn up about it. And he could make it rain indoors for hours, and the rain would crawl up the walls, and the prison guards would see it, cops saw it, but then people looked at it and says it wasn't normal rain; it was thicker, oily.
Yeah. That again sounds very familiar. Is there a book about this guy?
They did a Donnie show. I think they did a. Did they do a Paranormal Witness about him?
Yeah, they did a Paranormal Witness.
I know there was a show about.
Yeah, I'd really like to talk to him. I want to know if I
wrote about him because I don't know if you know, but I wrote another book called The Unseen Hand, which was kind of like a compilation of poltergeist cases, like from going back to medieval times to modern. And I actually did kind of a skeptical view on that. I wanted like an encyclopedia of poltergeist things because there didn't really seem to be anything really like that. So I did one. A lot of them to me sounded like bullshit, but I included them all anyway. I didn't get too snotty about it unless it was something that was like obviously fake, like the Amityville.
She made it as a reference book.
But, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But yeah, I had a lot of good time. I had a good time doing that. And like I said, I wrote a couple with Steve Mara also.
I did read. Was it the one in Seattle? Was it the Boothill House?
Yeah, it was Keith Linders. That guy's name, right?
Yeah, Keith Linders.
I wrote a book with Steve Mara, who is a British parapsychologist, because he actually came over and stayed in that dude's house for 2 or 3 weeks, and so I wrote the book with Steve Mara about him being there. So it was mostly from Steve Mara's point of view, like just what he saw when he was there. Keith Linder wrote his own book later about his own experiences. I'm not real sure how I feel.
I'm very skeptical.
I'm kind of skeptical of some of the stuff that he saw beforehand. Yeah. Like I said, the book that I wrote was just from Steve Mara's point of view, what he told me, because I talked to Steve Mara for hours and hours. Like I interviewed him over Zoom or whatever. And he just told me, this is what we got. He sent me all the data, all the scientific data he collected. And he stayed in the dude's house, him and his
Steve's very impartial.
Him and his assistant.
He just
assistant.
Says what he found.
Right.
They stayed there for 3 weeks. They stayed there for 2 weeks. Yeah, yeah. And then I think like a few months later, they came back and stayed for another week. And they set everything up around
that. He captured a few phenomena, but it wasn't like to the magnitude of what.
Although they did capture some weird shit in there. Yeah, yeah. I will say that.
But I think Linder exaggerates a lot. I think he's.
I think that too.
He's average.
But like I said, it doesn't mean, and I think I mentioned this in my Poltergeist book, and we've talked about that when we talked about the Enfield case and everything like that. Just because some of the people fake some shit some of the time, that doesn't mean it's all fake.
Because you'll have a prankster get in there and hoax something because they didn't see anything, so they'll hoax something, and then they'll try to include that into the body of evidence, and another. People are like, no, that didn't happen.
Well, especially when you start getting some publicity and the media starts showing up and then everybody starts freaking out.
If Ed, Lorraine, like, Warren show up, they're going to fake some shit so they can claim control over that case and write a whole book about it. They were known for it.
Yeah.
They were known for it.
We did a couple shows about Ed, Lorraine, Warren. They were
hucksters.
Those, interestingly, we don't get a lot of negative comments on a lot of our shows, weirdly.
Except those.
But those ones, a lot of people.
I don't believe anything that Ed and Lorraine say.
I don't either.
But you're saying that a lot of supporters of theirs were upset at what you guys said.
Very upset.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not saying every case they showed up on was fake, because they actually did show up to the
on some good cases.
They showed up to Enfield, but here's the thing. They said that they were called there. Everybody that worked on Enfield said, no, they just showed up.
Yeah.
Like uninvited.
And they were only there for a few hours.
And they were only there for a couple hours. They didn't see shit.
And then they wrote a whole story about all
this
bullshit.
Showed up so they even made, like, you know, one of the Conjuring movies was about that. And I'm like, they were barely there. No one asked them.
The other case that I take as real is Enfield Poltergeist. And we have the book right here. It's called This House is Haunted by Guy Lyon Playfair. That is a very good book, and that is the same phenomenon I witnessed, although it's manifested slightly differently, and I don't believe all the witnesses, but I believe the cops, the people that were there regularly. I don't believe the crosswalk girl up the road who saw her floating over the – maybe she did, but there was only one person that saw that, and she was running the crosswalk a half a mile up the road.
Well, is that a matter of the bigger the thing is, the kind of the less you believe it.
Yeah, I tend to. Yeah. I saw my shit was pretty fucking impressive, but it wasn't that impressive.
No one was floating around.
And you know what I mean? And so the most impressive case that I believe was the Rain Man. And I want to meet him. And it's because too many cops, too many prison guards, wardens, chaplains come to see this guy.
And they didn't really have any reason.
And they had no reason to conspire on this. And then people who knew him, that were taking care of him, had to get him out of the house because he was ruining the house. Just water coming out of the ceilings.
All right. I want to check that out. Meat. So, Jenny, let me ask you, what's you've written paranormal nonfiction. You've written paranormal fiction. Where are you right now? What's coming up for you? What interests you now?
I just put out, because I'd been working on, for the last few years, I was working on like a true crime. I got into true crime. And so I wrote a 3-volume thing called The Faceless Villain, which was a bunch of unsolved crimes from the 20th century. So I think the first one was like 50 years, and then the second was 20 years, and it was 20 years. And I just put out another one of those that was just unsolved murders from the year 2000. So I'm going to do like another one of those that's going to be all unsolved murders from 2001. And I've also been working on forever, and I just kind of got back into it. I'm doing a novel, but it's based on a weird unsolved true crime case, like a murder. But I'm kind of going supernatural with it. So we'll see how that goes. It's probably about half done. So... And so that's kind of, I've been kind of working on it off, because I, you know, I have like a quote unquote day job too. So I've kind of been working on that off and on, but hopefully I'll get that done. I don't know about this year, but
that's amazing.
Sure. Yeah.
That sounds great. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. The episode about your book has fascinated my listeners. They talk about it. They're going to love hearing from you guys. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, and we're going to link to all your books and everything you guys are working on now. So I would say thank you, and happy upcoming Halloween.
Cool. Hey, thank you very much.
If you need anything from us, man, just contact us. Just contact us if you need anything from us.
Yeah.
We Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.